Discussions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. Your host is Bonnie Bright.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Discussions in Depth Psychology, which is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. My name is Bonnie Bright, and I'm your host, and I'm also an alum of Pacifica. And I'm here today with Chris Hedges, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of 12 books, including his newest, Wages of Rebellion. Hi, Chris. Thanks for being with me.
Hi, Bonnie. Not at all.
Well, it's great to have you. And I know that we are going to be talking about a number of topics today, but primarily it's really exciting that Pacifica is going to be having you speak at their 40th anniversary celebration, which is coming up in April of 2016. And I know that the topic of your talk there is going to be on your newest book, Wages of Rebellion. Let me just read your bio, Chris, so that everybody knows a little bit more about you, and then we'll go from there. Chris Hedges, whose column is published weekly on truthdig.com, has written 12 books, including the New York Times bestseller Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, Death of the Liberal Class, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, and The Triumph of Spectacle, I Don't Believe in Atheists, and the best-selling American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. His book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. Hedges previously spent nearly two decades as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, and was part of the team of reporters at the New York Times, awarded a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for the paper's coverage of global terrorism. Hedges is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute in New York City. He has taught at Columbia University, New York University, Princeton University, and the University of Toronto. He currently teaches prisoners at a maximum security prison in New Jersey. Maybe we can start off a little bit and just, actually, let's back up a little bit and start with some background here. I have heard you described as being dark at times, and I wonder what's behind that, and if you just say a little bit about your approach to things as a journalist.
Well, I was a war correspondent for 20 years, so I certainly saw the worst that human beings can do to each other, and I understand the very dark side of human nature. I spent much of my time in disintegrating societies, places like Yugoslavia, Gaza, El Salvador, the famine in the southern Sudan. So, yeah, I grasp human evil. And when you live in the kind of indolence and splendor of the industrialized world, you can often, if you're privileged, create barriers that I think give you a very false sense of, what evil is and how to confront it.
Well, I have to say, I mean, dark is a topic that is often embraced in depth psychology. And of course, primarily, I suppose that a lot of our listeners are going to be depth psychologists or people that are coming from a background in that. And certainly the question of evil is part of that. But I also think that there are a lot of topics that are emerging in our culture and probably have existed in the history of our culture for a long time that are difficult for us to deal with. And I think that part of the problem with our culture is that we are not willing to embrace those. And so we have found and created so many different kinds of coping mechanisms that allow us to sort of disconnect from what the implications of what those are. And those can stem everything from, of course, climate and ecological issues, what we're doing to the planet, as well as governmental and political issues and just the way that we treat each other, social political issues. Maybe you can share with us a little bit about what your recent work has been around the idea of how these kinds of things are showing up in our culture and how you feel that we're dealing with those.
Well, like any society that's coping or attempting to cope with its own morbidity, and here I would go back to the Greeks, and in particular Plato, who understood that time is not linear, that both individuals as well as civilizations have cycles of growth, maturation, decay, decadence, and death. And of course, that's why Plato is often accused by people like Karl Popper of being a fascist, because Plato saw time itself as always bringing with it decay. And so he created these very draconian mechanisms in the Republic in order to essentially slow as much as possible any kind of movement, to create a society that was completely static. But even then, of course, he knew that the inevitable was coming. He just hoped to prolong the ideal society. And I think that that is a more accurate view of reality. I think history bears that out. We who come out of the Hebraic and Christian concept of time as linear, as moving towards something, are kind of an anomaly that's not found in most cultures and tribal cultures and Asian culture. And therefore, when we actually have the signs of morbidity around us, the climate, the ecocide that the fossil fuel industry is committing, the classic example of an empire expanding beyond its capacity to sustain itself, not a small issue, by the way, in the time of Plato, with Pericles, who was able to stave that off until his death. And the physical decay in terms of cities across the country, that inability to cope with reality means that morbidity expresses itself in other forms. We can see that in the election cycle, where discourse has descended to the level of an adolescence locker room, where we are fed, and the Democrats are as guilty of this as the Republicans, these manufactured political personalities that feel our pain, these celebrations of quote-unquote military virtues, the American character, all of these are signs that we as a culture are fleeing from the reality around us. Now, that's not uncommon. I'm not a Platonist, but we can go back to Plato, where he talks about most of the population being fed these illusions, you know, flickering on the wall of the cave. And so the question becomes, you know, what happens when somebody steps outside the cave and sees the manipulation and comes back to inform those people who are being entranced by illusions? And of course, we are entranced by our electronic hallucinations. Well, then they're killed. So, you know, any kind of grounding in history, and in particular, any study of how past civilizations have fallen apart from Easter Island to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, it has common patterns and common responses. And there was a very good book I read a few years ago called Easter Island, Easter Earth, that exposed all of that. You know, they're using their last final resources to build these giant stone figures and chopping down their last tree and eating their last egg out of a nest and until they commit, you know, sort of self-extinction. So, you know, you go back and look at the final years of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and writers like Joseph Roth and historian Fred Morton and others have written about that, you know, with variations and differences, we're not any different. Certainly, technologically, human society has progressed, but I don't think there you can argue that human nature has changed perceptibly in centuries, if not millenniums.
If not since the beginning of human civilization, yeah.
Right. I mean, I wasn't there, but we certainly haven't evolved much.
It doesn't seem like it, and yet it seems like, as particularly from a depth psychological standpoint, that's what we look at as being sort of our role here, is to evolve and to awaken on some level and to go into this process of what Jung called individuation, which of course is becoming more whole on some level. And I must have read an excerpt maybe from that same book that you just mentioned about Easter Island, and I remember something that I read specifically. It said, who was the guy who cut down the last tree?
It's like, that is from that book.
It is. So how can they not know that?
Like talk, so maybe it was one of my talks. But yeah, of course. I mean, what were they thinking? And the fact is they weren't thinking, and we're not thinking. And you know, the problem is that, you know, as these societies become so confronted with, you know, apocalyptic end, there is a kind of psychological mechanism by which people blind themselves. And those who seek to name that reality, you know, like Cassandra, become pariahs within the society. People don't want to hear it because the future is so bleak and so difficult. And I think we could take just the issue of climate change. That has certainly become our case. We live with two illusions. One, of course, that it doesn't exist, or two, that we can adapt, that somehow technology will adapt. Both are equally fantastical. And yet they are, it's a comforting belief system, but essentially it shuts us off from what's happening around us. So, you know, intellectuals, artists, their role, as Nietzsche pointed out, is to see and confront that reality, you know, that kind of what Nietzsche called that molten pit. And when they come back out, Nietzsche calls them burnt children. Of course, I mean, the thing with Nietzsche, he says that because people can't confront it, the role of the intellectuals and the artists is to create illusions. I mean, there I would disagree with Nietzsche. But certainly the fact that the seers within the society in times of distress are condemned and vilified, and we see that within our own society, it becomes kind of this sick mania for hope, in that if it's not hopeful, if it's not positive, then we don't want to hear it. And that, for me, coming out of war, having spent two decades covering wars, is dangerous. You know, we in war didn't use the words optimist or pessimist. We sought to understand the weapon systems arrayed against us at the end of that road and responded accordingly. But people had a very Pollyannish view of the world and somehow thought they were immune. And I knew young, particularly war correspondents. I mean, they always say the kind of cliche is that those who get killed in war are the ones who, you know, are very naive and first arrive on the battlefield and think they're invulnerable. And then the ones, as I became, the older ones who become kind of blasé about the danger because they think, oh, well, I've been through this in Algeria or El Salvador or something. You know, it becomes too familiar. But there's a kind of truth to that. I mean, I knew a correspondent in Sarajevo who, to taunt the Serb snipers, would get up in his car and drive across the tarmac, which was disputed territory on the old airport, to a Croatian town called Kiseljak to buy cigars and drive back. I mean, it was utter bravado. And he spray painted on the side of his car, "Save your bullets, I'm immortal," until, of course, he got shot and crippled. And I've known other correspondents who weren't as fortunate, who got killed. So I think you can extrapolate that to the society at whole, that when you don't confront the perils around you, when you build psychological mechanisms or walls, which we have done with the aid of technology and the aid of this culture, then you're almost guaranteed to commit collective suicide. And I think that's, you know, I'm accused of being dark. I'm dark because I think that's what's happening around us. And the consequences of it, not so much for me, but certainly for my children and for future generations, is catastrophic. Because if we don't radically reconfigure our relationship to each other and to the earth, we are going to have to begin to confront the extinction of the human species.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and everything around us, which begins to disintegrate as
yes,
we go.
Yes, and everything around us. I'm a vegan, so I won't pitch you with that, but you know, yes, all species. Yeah.
I go to an ecological film festival every year that is really, really exciting for me. And I've seen a lot of movies that talk about all of these things. And actually we have something sort of in common because I did most of my doctoral research on what I call culture collapse disorder, which is essentially parlaying from the colony collapse disorder that we're seeing in honeybee colonies and looking at how that's actually happening on a larger scale. But I wonder, you know, a lot of, I think what we're experiencing is, as a collective, is trauma, because we, on some level, even if we don't admit it, but if we look at it from an unconscious standpoint, I think everybody is aware that we're in dire straits and that things are happening that should not be happening and that are not natural. And that, I mean, you might argue that states of decline and collapse are natural, but we are in one of those. And as we look at, you know, we are cutting down the last trees. We are killing the rainforest. We are executing this. We may already be past the point of no return on the whole climate change issue. And people are going to suffer. And as we go through that, we are traumatized on many levels. Joanna Macy, whom you may know, is a Buddhist scholar and talks a lot about nature issues, has said that in some of her writings that we are, you know, we are aware that we are now for the first time ever maybe in danger of actually going extinct as a species, and that we are all carrying that with us on some level. So of course we turn to these coping mechanisms. I heard a lot of what you were saying. I related that to denial and the fact that, you know, we just can't face it because we are traumatized. And when we're traumatized, parts of us split off and just kind of get frozen in these little places. And we turn to other things. We turn to addictions, you know, we turn to drugs and alcohol and food and shopping. And I think it makes consumerism 10 times worse, even though that's part of the problem that we're facing. So if we're also,
it's hedonism. I mean, you satiate these immediate desires. Although, as Proust said, you know, the danger with this is that once you satiate a desire, it's just the starting point for new desires. But yes, I think that you see it in times of this, the films, you know, with the wizards and the Hunger Games and all. And yet it's the truth no one will name. So I think you're right. I think there is a kind of subterranean understanding that the ground is shifting in incredibly dramatic ways. And yet naming that reality, like naming your own mortality, is so difficult. And the society has built mechanisms of indoctrination around consumerism and around entertainment to buttress this non-reality-based belief system. So in this particular society, which had severed itself largely from print, where complex ideas are actually attainable, I would argue we're probably the most illusioned civilization in human history, that technology, rather than a boon or a mechanism by which we can be self-aware, has been used to essentially shut down the most basic understanding of who we are as individuals and who we are as a society.
Yeah, I agree completely. And it kind of brings us back to that whole idea of those who are seeing, those who actually can see what's happening and are willing to allow that to sort of be with them and to engage with that. You know, that's, I suppose maybe on some level, that's really the hope that we have for the future, is that some people will be willing to just go through that process of witnessing, because even if there's something that we can't, you know, if we can't do anything about what the trajectory is that we're on, there needs to be a certain number of people who are able to engage with that. I'm wondering, though, about this whole idea. I think that America is built on this idea of rugged individualism. It's a term that was kind of introduced, you know, a long time ago, for probably to describe our ancestors who were pioneers, who came across the country and had to face all of these terrible challenges with both nature and indigenous inhabitants that already had a home and were rising up against them, of course, in rebellion. But do you think that that idea has carried through into our culture? It's something that I think about a lot, that the only way that we can define success typically in American culture is to be the individual and to be the one who's achieving and to be the one who's always getting better. Where now corporations are, you know, basing all of their growth, it has to be growth process every single year. Of course, this is a huge part of the problem. What do you think about the way that that's showing up in our culture?
Well, you know, a better term for it might be Hannah Arendt's term of atomization, that with the destruction of, you know, there's that famous book, Bowling Alone, that came out a few years ago, but there's a kind of truth to it, that all of those communal organizations, whether they were benign in terms of stamp clubs or bowling leagues or whatever, but that also translates into civic organizations, have been obliterated, and people have retreated into their kind of very narrow circles and cut themselves off from everyone around them, and from those organizations, as de Tocqueville made clear, made participatory democracy possible. And so it doesn't matter whether it's NASCAR or church services or historical societies, nobody shows up anymore. Or the people who show up are elderly or older because they haven't been as infected with this culture. And with this atomization comes this very dangerous cult of the self, which seeps into every aspect, including spirituality. I mean, I come out of the church, but the church itself has done this. So spirituality doesn't remain rooted in that biblical precept, which is about your neighbor. It's about how is it with my neighbor? It's about the stranger on the side of the road, but how is it with me? And that severs you from, I think, the fundamental call of religious or spiritual belief, which is justice. And justice not for us, but justice for the vulnerable. And all of this has empowered forces within the society, corporate forces, buttressed by the most pervasive security and surveillance apparatus in human history. And I covered the collapse of East Germany and the Stasi state. It has removed, especially on a local level, mechanisms that I think once protected us from arbitrary and capricious forms of power. And that has been both physically and ideologically.
Yeah. Yes, I agree with you completely. I think that there is, this whole culture of the self, it's funny because we see this, it's prolific, it's pervasive everywhere. You see the rise of selfies. And I know part of that has to do with the fact that technology has made it possible for us to take the phone and reach up there and be able to take a selfie. But on the other hand, it's like, what's the movement behind that? You know, what is driving that? And I think on some level, it's probably a search for context. It's a search for meaning. Like we're trying to put ourselves in context of what is it that we're doing here and what is happening around us, because we often take those kinds of pictures in various settings, and they're usually either with other people or in nature or in historical sites when we're traveling, those kinds of things. So, but this whole idea of community and the whole civic movement that you were talking about and how that's kind of disappearing, I think that takes us back to the whole tribal societies and how they have really largely disappeared, and particularly are not valued as much in our culture today. And James Hillman, who is a Jungian psychologist and really one of the founding fathers of Pacifica Graduate Institute, he's kind of a pioneer of archetypal psychology. And I pulled this quote from him because I was thinking about the idea of tribal psychologies, which we might, I guess, refer to it as. And he says, soul making must be reimagined. We have to go back before Romanticism, back to medieval alchemy and Renaissance Neoplatonism, back to Plato, which is where you were going before, back to Egypt, and especially out of Western history to tribal animistic psychologies that are always mainly concerned not with individualities, but with the soul of things. So environmental concerns, deep ecology, as it's now called, and propitiatory acts that keep the world on its course.
Well, it's a question of a society that honored the sacred, as pre-modern, we'll call them, societies did, and a society where nothing has an intrinsic value, which is what a corporate capitalist society is. Everything has exclusively a monetary value, that including human beings, including the natural world, that you exploit until exhaustion or collapse. And such societies, as Carl Pogliani points out in The Great Transformation, have built within them their own self-annihilation, because, and Pogliani, although he's an economist, actually uses the word sacred, because they don't have the capacity to understand the sacred, and because they've lost the capacity for reverence for the sacred. They don't even have the vocabulary, I think, to grasp what the sacred is. Then they destroy the very life forces that sustain the earth and sustain human community. And I think that that's correct. I think that, you know, Freud's understanding that at certain moments in human history, thanatos or the death instinct is ascendant, as it is with individuals, propels societies and even offers a kind of seductive appeal towards self-obliteration. And I think that we live in a thanatos moment.
Yes. Yeah, C.G. Jung often referred to this, I think what you're describing, as the return of the repressed. So these things that we are constantly trying to push down and not think about and try to distract ourselves from are actually rising back up, and they're going to rise up in a way that they will get attention regardless. And as we start to see that in the disintegration of things around us, I believe that that is what's happening.
Yeah, I think that the society is, you know, there are all sorts of ways that morbidity is expressing itself now throughout the culture. We can start with pornography and the lust for violence, consumerism, a multiplicity of ways that that morbidity is expressing itself because we as a society have been unable to face that reality. And because, in essence, we are fleeing, we are looking for mechanisms to flee from that reality. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fleeing, or there's a really, there's a really interesting book that I have been fascinated by for years by someone named Philip Cushman, who is also a psychologist. And the name of that book is Constructing America, Constructing the Self. And in it, he talks about this notion, which probably isn't new, but I really like the way that he terms it and talks about it. He talks about this notion of an empty self and the idea that we as individuals are disconnected from that sense of something that's larger. And in your, you know, the term that you used was the sacred. And I also really like that term. Of course, it's not one of those terms that we can use widely in society and expect people to really connect with and understand what that's about. But this whole idea of the empty self, we are, because we're not connected to that something larger, we're constantly looking for ways to stuff that emptiness inside of us. And of course, this is where a lot of these challenges come to us. So the question is, how do you think we can individually or as a culture begin to move more into that space of meaning, to reconnect with something that is larger than ourselves, that actually brings the kind of connection and meaning to the world around us, to each other as human beings, to our, you know, four-legged and winged people that are out there? How do we begin? Because this seems like such an overwhelming task sometimes in the face of what seems like a very shallow and disconnected world.
We have to build walls between ourselves and the rest of the culture. I mean, I don't have a television. I don't have a Facebook page. I don't tweet. I don't have a web page. I Instagram. I don't do any of that. I make sure and I remain rooted in print. I think the severance from the natural world has been frightening. I grew up in the country. I spend 5 weeks every summer in the White Mountains and have since I was 7 years old, and have raised my kids all summer long in those mountains, again, severed from the internet, severed from television. I think that these intrusions are actually ones that have fed the decay, the desensitivity, the numbness, even the idiocy of the wider culture, and they're so pervasive. I mean, even though I don't have a television, I spend enough time in hotels and airports. I don't turn the hotel TV on in my room, but there's always one blaring down in the restaurant. I mean, I know who Kim Kardashian is. I don't want to know who she is. I'd be deeply conversant in popular culture, but I can't shut it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's impossible to disconnect on every level. But I wonder if there's something more, and I think it's really important what you're saying. I do believe that if we constantly are distracting ourselves as a coping mechanism and have that, you know, blasting to prevent us from maybe thinking about the worst things that there are to think about. And I'm wondering if there's also an element of it, which you alluded to, and that is that seeking out nature, really, being able to spend time in nature and whether you're consciously trying to connect with something or not, I don't think that's the point. I think the point is that that we are nature, and once we're in it, we sort of are readopted back into that natural way of being that we have been so sorely missing.
Well, we understand our significance in the universe. I mean, when you are on top of a 4,000-foot mountain in the White Mountains watching the Perseus meteor shower, you begin to grasp that you not only are not the center of the universe, but you are a very, in the sort of span of time, you are an ephemeron. And that's very healthy. And that's deeply religious. I mean, that's the whole Ash Wednesday, you are dust and to dust you will return. I think that the cult of the self thrives on this massive elevation of ourselves out of all proportion to who we are within the society, who we are within the span of time, and connecting with the past. I mean, historical amnesia is one of the fruits of, any totalitarian-based or spectacle-based society. All totalitarian societies are spectacle-based. And we've lost connection with the voices of our ancestors, with those who went before us, with those who thought about these issues, with those who can free us from the cant of modernity. It can reflect, I mean, I think of Aristotle, it can reflect on, you know, what it means to have a life of meaning, what it means to participate within a society. All of these things are issues that the great artists and writers and intellectuals have struggled with. But when you're cut off from those voices, then in many ways you're cut off from what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very true. And, you know, it brings me back to Thomas Berry, who's a real hero of mine. He's, I guess, referred to as a geologian. He was a theologian and, of course, was involved in the geology of things. But he talks about how poetry and art can be the language that brings us, you know, it reminds us, it brings us back to that forgotten connection with nature. So if we're not able to be on that mountain looking at the meteor shower, we can come back to art and poetry, which is the bridge between us.
No, I mean, art and poetry grapples with the non-rational, beauty, truth, grief, the struggle with our own mortality, love. When Freud said, I can never write about love. I can write about sex. I can't write about love. Those mysteries that go into making a complete and a whole human being. And, you know, as the Buddhist said, you can memorize as many sutras as you want. It will never make you wise. If you're not in touch with those non-rational forces, then you are stunted and you end up, in essence, with this a monomaniacal vision of the technocrat who has reduced all of reality, this narrow specificity, but yet on all of the larger, and I would argue even important issues of life is moronic. And those are the people who are celebrated within the society, like Bill Gates. Hope he's not funding your conference.
Hopefully not. Well, Chris, it's been so interesting to talk to you today. I really appreciate you spending the time with us, and I look very much forward to seeing your talk at the 40th anniversary celebration for Pacifica in April. And I thank you again for being with me.
Thank you, Bonnie.
You've been listening to Discussions in Depth Psychology, powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute with host Bonnie Bright.